Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill.
Looking at current affairs and culture from a different angle.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at Tilt UK.
Hello, you're listening to Tilt at the Mill. I'm Mark Thompson, here with you for the next hour or so. Coming up, I'll be joined by Mark Wadsworth to discuss land value tax. Now, this is something, it's an idea that's been around for a long old time. I think it's hundreds of years old, but for some reason it never really seems to gain much political traction. Seems to be off in the way with ideas that when you actually look into them actually seem quite good, and yet for some reason they're nowhere near the top of the political agenda. So we'll have a little chat about that and find out what it's all about, and maybe try and find out why we think it's it hasn't gained the traction it might have done. And then later I'll be talking to Claire Barrett, the Financial Times personal finance editor, to discuss the plight of younger people trying to get on the property ladder. Obviously, that's a problem that we hear about quite a lot. So, yeah, we'll be finding out a little bit more about that and perhaps what we can do about it. OK, you're listening to Mark Thompson on the Music Mill, Tilt at the Mill. And we are now going to talk about a subject that I've read a fair bit about over the years. I mean, being a bit of a political geek and also a former Lib Dem, it's a policy that the Lib Dems have been quite keen on over the years. Land value tax. It's a different way of getting tax in, you know, in large amounts, as opposed to like corporation tax or income tax. Rather than me waffle on about it, though, I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Wadsworth, who is from the Young People's Party and an expert on land value tax. He's written about it many a time on his blog, that's worth a read as well. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening, Mark.
So, land value tax, do you want to just give us a quick précis on what it's all about?
At its simplest, it is just a simplification of existing taxes on housing, wealth, household wealth, you name it. You know, the modest approach is to say, let us take stamp duty land tax, which is a tax on land values, but it's a bad tax on land values because it discourages upsizing, moving, downsizing, selling, buying, and inheritance tax, which is, you know, most of what is caught by inheritance tax is, of course, housing, which is three quarters of total household wealth. And there's the television license fee, which is a poll tax, the council tax, which is almost a poll tax, you know, and a few other things, and just smooth them out. Replace all those revenues with one single tax at a flat percentage of the rental value of each site or the selling price of each home, and have done with it.
I mean, so it sounds like you think that there are quite a lot of taxes that we currently have that could be replaced with land value tax. Because I think one of the objections when people start hearing about a new tax is that they start to worry, oh, here we go again. Here's another tax on top of all the other taxes. I mean, if you think about, you know, when things like stamp duty were introduced, when VAT were introduced, you know, they were always in addition to the other taxes, and it's yet more levers that any Chancellor of the Exchequer can pull, can ratchet things up. VAT's gone up from initially 8%, it went up to 15%, because I think the government promised they wouldn't double it, and they didn't. They put it up to 15%, then 17.5%, now it's at 20%, etc. So do you encounter this a lot, that people are just very cynical about the idea of another tax because they don't think it will replace other taxes, they just think it will be an addition to them?
In fairness, yes. That is one of the few arguments that cannot be countered. That is one of the few arguments that cannot be countered because politicians will do whatever they want to do. However, people who are interested in economics and land value tax in particular all say it should replace other taxes. We have so many terrible taxes. We accept that land value tax will in itself be unpopular. However, if the flip side were, we get rid of council tax, we get rid of stamp duty land tax, we get rid of inheritance tax, we get rid of the TV license fee, that would ensure that there are relatively few winners and relatively few losers. You know, it would just spread it more evenly. Instead of paying a huge great lump of stamp duty land tax when you buy or sell a house, you would just pay a little bit more council tax every year.
So that's effectively what you see it as, like the equivalent of a council tax type tax?
Yes. For a start, for a very modest start, being realistic and having read what other people say, you know, from every party, the Lib Dems, even the Tories, UKIP, the Greens, most reasonable people say, look, we have a poll tax on housing, which is council tax and a TV licence fee. We have two hyper-progressive taxes on housing, which is stamp duty, land tax and inheritance tax. Why not throw them in a pot? We know how much revenues we need from that. Divide that by the value of housing, it comes to much less than 1%, and have done with it. And everybody just pays, you know, a small percentage, 0.5% or 0.75% of what their house is worth. So for people in lower value housing, they would see absolutely no difference. It would be the same as council tax. For people in higher value housing, they would see, oh, my annual bill is much more, but I don't have to worry about inheritance tax. If I want to move out of it, you know, sell this home and buy another one, I don't have to pay stamp duty land tax. And it would all, you know, there would be a lot of grumbling, but that would be, you know, a politically acceptable way of doing things.
So when you say there'd be a lot of grumbling, I mean, the people who are likely to grumble the loudest are the people who would lose out the most. The people who would lose out the most are the people who own the most land, basically, or own the land that's in the most valuable areas. Because if my understanding is correct, land value tax is what it says on the tin. It's the value of the land. So therefore, if you own, you know, a quarter of an acre in the middle of the Scottish Highlands, that's not going to be worth anything like as much as owning a quarter of an acre in the centre of London, and the tax that you will pay will reflect the value of the land that you've got and the amenities that are around it, etc. So people who own expensive bits of land, who coincidentally tend to be the people who are listened to most by politicians for various reasons that we could go into, are the ones who are going to kick off the most about this, and make it very difficult for it to come in, aren't they?
Yes, indeed, and they have been very successful in that over the past, you know, 50 years. I mean, business rates, the existing business rates on commercial premises is actually surprisingly close to land value tax. It's 3/4 of the way there, you know, but we, you know, I mean, I live in London and I see new skyscrapers going up every single week. So that proves the point that business rates does not discourage, you know, building office buildings and renting out office buildings. Referring to a quarter of an acre is a bit of a mistake, because the disparity between a value of some grouse moor in the Highlands and the value of the same amount of land in London or in the city centre of Birmingham or Manchester is roughly 100,000 to 1. There is no comparison whatsoever.
That's interesting, because, I mean, the reason why I chose it was because I assumed there would be quite a big difference, but I was guessing maybe a factor of 20 or 50 or 100.
No. I mean, theoretically, there are parts of Bond Street, the very, very most expensive, or the most expensive part of street in the most expensive town in the UK, is, in fact, worth a million times as much as a grouse moor in the Highlands or a forest in, you know, a forest somewhere on a hillside.
OK, so I wonder if we're maybe starting to put our finger on one of the biggest, in fact the biggest barrier to this, which is political will, which is obviously my specialist subject. I talk about and write about politics quite a lot, and really the reason why it's not gained political traction, you think, is because the people who would lose out are the people who are most influential in our political system.
Well, firstly, yes, there's that, but there's the other point that Margaret Thatcher stumbled across this, possibly innocently. John Major did a U-turn and said, no, this is wrong. Tony Blair and Gordon Brown did it in spades, that you can bribe people with rising house prices. You know, you can either, if somebody's, instead of everybody getting a £10,000 pay rise every year, they were told every year, oh, your house has gone up in value by £10,000. It is very easy for politicians to bribe people with rising house prices. And the easy way to achieve rising house prices is to reduce the holding cost. Whether you do that by pushing down interest rates, or whether you do that by, you know, replacing domestic rates with a poll tax or with council tax, or whether you do, you know, there are lots of ways of doing it, or whether you just do it with very, very, very lax banking regulation, that pushes up house prices. Everybody who has a house, who owns a home, which is still more than half of adults in the UK, thinks this is lovely. And you can plot a graph. In fact, I have plotted a graph, you know, annual change in house prices and how popular the government is. You know, that was why John Major lost, because he allowed house prices to drop. That was why Labour got chucked out in 2010, because they allowed house prices to drop. And that is why the current government, you know, they have been handed the poison chalice by Blair and Brown. They have to got to keep this going with Help to Buy and funding for lending and stamp duty breaks for first-time buyers and all these things. They've just got to keep going. That's why it's not a question of political will, it's a question of political self-preservation. If you want to stay in government in this country, you have to keep house prices going up, because history teaches if you let them fall, you are doomed.
So it's kind of everyone's fault then, or at least everyone who owns a home or aspires to own a home, that we're in the situation that we're in with rising house prices and a complete lack of political will to look at innovative ways of addressing that.
But yes, that is a rather depressing but possibly the most realistic way of looking at it.
Because really what you're saying, if Osborne was serious about his stated aim of trying to make, you know, trying to enable people to buy their own homes more easily, then he'd implement this in a heartbeat, wouldn't he? Because it would address quite a lot of the problems that you've talked about. But that just kind of demonstrates that it's really just rhetoric. And for, like,
oh,
you say, for reasons...
Rhetoric. It's complete and utter rhetoric. It is pure rhetoric. Land value tax, or, you know, let us call it domestic rates to be realistic, you know, worked, provably worked. We had a whole bundle of policies in this country that old people don't like to talk about that kept house prices down. That is why, when I was young, even school teachers would say, oh, England has got the highest rate of owner occupation in Europe. We're at 70%, we're at 75%. Isn't that brilliant? And all the children would sit there in the classroom and say, yes, it is brilliant. My mum and dad own our house, you know, and it was lovely. But the only way to do that is to jump in a time machine, go back 30 or 40 years, reintroduce domestic rates, have higher taxes on landlords, have very strict banking regulations, or shut down the banks, only allow building societies to lend, three times income, and so on. It must be clear, if you can only borrow three times your income, house prices will not be higher than three times income. It's easy to do. Land value tax is a bit of a hypothetical, but the old policies, if you can't borrow more than three times your income or twice your joint income, houses won't cost more than three times income. It's just impossible. You know? And they used to have very high taxes on landlords, so all the landlords threw in the towel. You know, from the over the 20th century, it went down from 90% of people being private rented sector down to 10% being in the private rented sector.
Yeah. It's interesting what you're saying about home ownership and renting and this whole kind of Englishman's home is his castle type thing that, you know, we've all grown up with, and I declare an interest. I own my own home, and I have done for many years, and, you know, most of my friends do in one form or another. And I remember 25 years ago, it was 1991, I went travelling around Europe and ended up staying with some friends of my family's in Holland for a few days. And I was talking to a woman who, I think she was about 22... she had a baby, 22, 23, something like that. She had a young baby and she was living in a flat. It was a nice flat. It was like a two-bedroom flat. And I was talking to her and I said, you know, oh, do you own this flat? And she said, oh, no, I just rent it. And I said, okay, all right. Well, so you're going to be buying, what, trying to buy it or buy another flat in a couple of years' time? And she said, why would I want to do that? I can just rent it. I don't need to think about buying property. I'll just rent. And it was so strange to hear that, because most people in her situation in the UK, I mean, I think she was a, you know, she had a baby, but she was a professional. I think she was back at work at that point. And there would just be no question that in the UK, a person in that situation would be trying, or at least thinking about how they were going to ultimately buy a property. Whereas for her, it just wasn't an issue at all. And I think that just kind of demonstrated the fundamental disparity in the structure of the property market in the UK as versus, I think that happens in quite a lot of Europe, actually.
It is what happens in a lot of Europe. But this is the problem. Does the mentality shape the legislation, or does the legislation shape the mentality? You know, on most of the continent, and I can only speak specifically about Germany, where I lived for 9 years, they have implicit and explicit rent controls. When I was there, I rented, all my friends rented. And I said to them, it's very strange, isn't it? Because we can afford to rent. Mm-hmm, yes, we can. And our landlord can afford to buy this house or flat. Yes, he can. But we can't afford to buy the house or flat. That was just the mentality. There were insane subsidies, on the one hand, insane subsidies for landlords to push the price up, which they were prepared to pay, but on the other hand, there were rent controls. So, you know, the rental yield was something like 2% or something. You know, you would never be able to afford that flat, but you can easily afford to rent it. It's very good quality housing. They have, you know, proper building standards. They have, you know, does the mentality shape the legislation? Does the legislation shape the mentality? I really don't know. But if you are renting in Germany, in most parts of Germany, you've got a good deal, you've got a secure tenancy, the landlord can't just throw you out on a whim, it's good quality housing, the rents are controlled, you know, to keep it down to maybe a fifth or a sixth of your income, and everybody's happy with that. But, you know, in England, there's this rapacious thing that landlords can charge as much as they want, chuck you out when they like, you know.
Indeed, and I've experienced that myself. I mean, although I own a house now, and I have done for about 12 years. Back when I used to rent, I was evicted from a flat that I was in. And it was all a bit weird the way it happened, because I actually got made redundant from a job I was in. I knew I'd find another job pretty quickly. I'm in a fairly secure industry, and I did. It only took me about 3 months. But I made the mistake of telling the lettings agency. I really shouldn't have done, and I was advised not to. But I thought, no, I'll be honest with them, and I told them. Next thing you know, they insisted on 3 months' rent up front, and then as soon as I paid them that, they then served eviction on me. And apparently the landlord, in quotes, wanted to move his son into the flat. I don't know whether that was true or not. But the point was, I had very little security of tenure. In fact, I had none. I was out on my backside. So I've experienced it firsthand. And that is one of the big problems with privately renting in the UK. There is really no security of tenure to speak of. Another problem, which is about the economics of this. We moved house about a year and a half ago, but we'd lived in the house that we were previously in for about 10 years. And when I, because I'm a bit of a geek and I like to sit there with spreadsheets and work stuff out, when I worked out how much the house had appreciated by, how much we'd paid in terms of mortgage interest, because I'm not going to include the mortgage capital, because anything that we pay off the mortgage capital comes back to us anyway. So what we just paid in terms of mortgage interest and all the rest of it, I added it all up and I worked out that actually we'd effectively been able to live in that house for free for 10 years. Whereas if we'd been paying rent, we'd have just paid someone else like whatever it would have been,
£100,000. That's the beauty of the system. If you are slightly economically illiterate and count the house price gain as income, then, you know, until about the year 2000, the actual cost was negative. You know, the cost was negative.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's much more difficult because interest rates are effectively zero.
Mm.
So the cost is an even bigger negative, but that's rather mad.
Mm. Just in the last few minutes that we've got, I'd like to just unpack another aspect of this, which I know you've written about a lot on your blog and I've read in other places as well, which is about how a land value tax would actually help to kind of, almost like a form of social justice or enabling the state to be able to kind of get money for things that they've done. So, for example, if you own a house and it's kind of in the middle of nowhere and there's not much going on, and then suddenly there's a road through the middle, and then, you know, utilities put a load of stuff in, and then there's a huge shopping complex built not too far away, and you know, there's other stuff, and suddenly it becomes like a vibrant area, and your house suddenly doubles or triples in value because of everything else that's going on around it, nothing to do with what you've done. Well, then of course at the moment that's just a complete gain. You'll just make a massive amount of money through no efforts of your own. Whereas under a system of land value tax, your tax would go up because your house would be worth more. Do you want to just talk a little bit more about that and about how that kind of that might work in reality? I mean, have I kind of got that right? Is that part of the point of a land value tax?
Mark, that is exactly right.
Okay.
However, you say what the state has done. You know, we land value taxes refer to community-generated land values.
Yeah.
A chain, you know, you need lots of things. You need roads built by the, you know, maintained by the local council. You need schools financed by the central government. You need a shopping centre financed privately. You need private house builders to build houses. You need people to live there and actually use the shops and keep their front gardens tidy. And you need a utility company to provide water and electricity. It is the whole of the nation, the whole of the community, the whole of the economy that generates these land values. And we glibly say it's community-generated land value, rental value, that belongs to the community which generated it. He belongs a little bit to the utility company, a little bit to the supermarket owner, a little bit to the people who live there, and so on. And the opponents say, no, no such thing, not community-generated land value. However, if you watch the property porn programs on television, they'll always say, this is an up-and-coming location. It's all about location, location, location. It's all about, you know, if a station is going to be built, that's where you want to buy a house because it will go up in value. So we are saying exactly the same thing, aren't we? You know, we're saying exactly the same thing. The estate agents always say it's about location, location, location. And land value taxes say exactly the same. It's about location, 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 which is created by the wider community. So it's an ideal thing to tax because it does it belong to anybody in particular? Does it belong to everybody? Does it belong to nobody? Does it belong to the whole nation, the state, the government, the people? We can argue about the precise wording, but it certainly doesn't belong to somebody who says, oh yeah, I've heard a station's going to be built, I'm going to buy some land there, wait till the station's built, then rake in a massive windfall gain.
It's very interesting though, because you're right, but I wonder if this just speaks to a kind of almost subliminal mindset within the UK psyche, which is that although people might recognise the fact that, you know, on these television programmes they will say, well, it's the location and you're near a train station and you're near these shops and blah, 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 and that's, you know, why the property's worth more. If you happen to buy somewhere and then those things are built around you, you don't think of it as, OK, well, that's a community gain. You think of it as, well, I was quite smart. I bought a house in an up-and-coming area. And even though it's, you know, in a lot of cases, blind luck, you still think, oh, well, I was a smart investor and, you know, an Englishman's home is his castle and, you know, I deserve these gains. People don't think of it in the same way once they own a property and, you know, and they live somewhere or a piece of land even.
No, people don't think of it in the same way. But you have now said for the second time, an Englishman's home is his castle. And I don't know when and where this phrase originated and how cynical the person was who invented it. But, you know, it is nice to own your own home. It is. That's your castle, so to speak, inverted commas. You can decorate it how you like. You can listen to what music you like. You can stay there as long as you like. You've got to keep the mortgage bank happy. Apart from that, fine. However, current policies, and I'm blaming the new Labour government more than the Tory government, are clearly seeing owner occupation rates plummet like a stone, you know, so there are fewer people who have their own castle, if you want to be melodramatic about it. You know, my parents bought a house in the 60s, they'd sold it in the 90s, it had appreciated nicely 2 or 3% a year. That's lovely, they made a nice paper gain. But it was nothing special. However, the fact that they didn't make a gain means that lots of other people could buy their own house. You know, and everybody had a castle. We had 10% in private rented sector, 20% in social housing, and 70% of people were homeowners. It was perfectly easy to save a deposit and buy your own house at the age of 25 or 30 at the latest. And everybody had their castle. It was much better. And that wasn't even land value tax. They didn't have land value tax. They had domestic rates. They had rent controls. You could always cop out and go for social housing, which of course keeps rent down. They had mortgage restrictions and all the other bits and pieces that they had. So people say land value tax is the opposite of an Englishman's home is his castle is wrong. With land value tax, there will be fewer landlords and there will be much higher owner occupation rates because that would keep house prices down. So more people would be able to afford it. So there would be more Englishmen having homes as castles.
Indeed.
That's how they flip the language round.
Yeah. Just before we finish, do you think there's a realistic chance of land value tax or a form of it happening in, say, the next 20 years? Maybe I'm thinking we keep hearing about how corporation tax rates are declining and it's very difficult to do anything about it because, you know, you can... multinational corporations can move IP wherever they want to the lowest tax rates, whereas you can't move land. Do you think eventually the logic of that argument will just be too difficult to ignore and something will have to change, something like this will come in?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question.
Thank you.
But bearing in mind that for the past 30 years or so, the game has been, if you want to stay in government, you must keep the prices going up. We don't care what deficits we run. The Tories are running massive deficits. If you buy a house in London under Help to Buy, they will lend you £240,000 interest-free just to keep house prices going up. And on the other hand, they're running these massive deficits that they were blaming on Labour. You know, from that narrow point of view, no, it's very unlikely. Sad to say, despite so many people across the political spectrum, from the Greens to UKIP, I know people in every party who say, yes, land value tax is either the best tax or at least the least bad tax. But somehow it boils down to the Daily Mail and the Telegraph and the Express all saying, you can't tax this, this is my castle. But if you're a landlord and somebody else lives there, how is that your castle?
Mark, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thanks very much for your time this evening. How can people, you know, follow you on social media and read your blog?
You just have to type in Mark Wadsworth, and my blog is one of the first things that comes up.
Good stuff.
Or
okay.
Type in Young People's Party and see what happens.
Yeah, okay. Good stuff. So that's Mark Wadsworth talking to us about land value tax there, which is a subject I don't know, maybe we'll hear more about over the coming years, although I suspect the cynic in me thinks that maybe things will just carry on the way they have done.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at TiltUK.
Hello, you're listening to Tilt at the Mill. I'm Mark Thompson here with you for about the next 25 minutes. Bit of a theme tonight. Usually we have two different topics and they're two very different topics from each other. But tonight, the two topics kind of segue into each other. So we were talking about land value tax in the first half with Mark Wadsworth. What we're going to talk about in the second half is the plight of young people with respect to trying to buy property and to own their own home, which is something that a generation or two ago was a realistic aspiration for people, say, in their 20s or early 30s, earning a reasonable amount of money, say the national average or a bit more, could have a decent shot at buying a property. But nowadays, that is a lot more tricky. I'm delighted to be joined by Claire Barrett, who is the personal finance editor of the Financial Times. Good evening, Claire.
Good evening.
I wanted to talk about young people's prospects for owning property, because it's one of those things that, like I say, about a generation ago, young people could certainly aspire to own their own homes, and it was a realistic possibility, whereas nowadays it's getting pretty tricky. You keep hearing the average age of first-time buyers is going up and up and up, and I regularly hear on the media interviews with young people who are earning good amounts of money, especially in London. You know, they might be earning £50,000, £60,000, £70,000 a year, and they still can't afford to even get a shoebox. I mean,
it's nowhere near enough in London.
It's a real problem, isn't it?
It is a real problem, and it's not just a problem for people who might want to choose to own their own home. It's a big problem for business as well, which is why the FT takes it so seriously, and we report a lot about the wider social consequences of what's happening to the housing market. And I think to call it a housing crisis is a gross underestimate. I mean, you need £91,000 today as a first-time buyer in London for the average deposit to buy the average priced, well, we say home. You're not going to get a house for that. You're going to get a flat. If you're buying a flat, and it will invariably be more expensive over the long run, you have to pay a service charge and other things like that. But let's start with that number, £91,000. So to save that money up as a young person, you have got to be a very diligent saver, but your biggest outgoing, ironically, is going to be your rent, because the cost of renting in the capital, and indeed across most of the UK, has also gone up quite hugely, because yet again demand is outstripping supply. So we did a story last week saying that within London the average first-time buyer spends nearly £70,000 on rent at the point where they come to buy a home. But for people who are actually starting to rent today, who hope to buy a home in 10 years' time, maybe, because that's the average amount of time you do have to spend renting, they'll have to save up they would have spent £90,000 on their rent before they have to come up with, on today's prices, another £91,000 for the deposit. So it's an absolute huge amount of money. Obviously, elsewhere in the country, it's not as bad as it is in London, but it's still very unaffordable because, of course, young people's wages are generally less outside of the capital. So what can you do? Well, lots of people, my own staff on the FT included, live further and further outside of London. One of my reporters is in Hertfordshire. Another one lives in Sussex. They have to commute in. The average cost of the commute for both of those people is about £3,000 a year. And it takes them over an hour in the morning and in the evening to get between their home and the office. And it also, I think, could potentially affect their careers because they can't go out to evening events as easily as the rest of us. They're tired because they're having to work long hours and travel on top of that. So that's invariably a bad thing. Sorry, got a bit of a cough at the moment. So in summation, if you want to save up that money for your deposit at the same time when you're working, it's pretty nigh on impossible to do unless you have help from your family.
Well, yeah, because I was going to come on to that, because one of the pernicious effects of the situation as it is at the moment is that although lots of young people are priced out of owning their own property, there are people, young people, for whom this isn't such a problem, even if they're not necessarily earning a huge amount of money themselves. If they've got wealthy parents, then they can subsidise and the bank of mum and dad can come in and help with that deposit or even just give them that deposit. And it
or
becomes much easier.
To get that, their own home to get that deposit, which is more common than a lot of people realise. And another thing that we're seeing, again, at the moment, more and more from all of the finance professionals we speak to, is that there was this huge shake-up to the pension rules last April. So when you're 55 years old and over from now on, you can access your pension funds. Now, there are tax penalties depending on how much you take, but this means that people who are in their late 50s and 60s can potentially get their hands on a large amount of cash. And the number one reason that people withdraw it, spend it, on something is doing up their own houses, like whether it's paying for an extension or redecorating. There's definitely a trend to invest in making your home as good as it can be. But another very, very popular reason is giving your children a housing deposit. So you're basically giving away your future income in retirement to help your children onto the property ladder. But it's a very, very emotive argument. I mean, if you're in a situation where, you know, you've got a son or a daughter who are renting, maybe they've just got married, they've got a baby on the way, maybe they've had a baby and they're living in a shoebox, it's really, really hard. So lots of them are making that decision. Financially, it's not going to be a very good one for them in the long term, but many feel that they don't have a choice.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's one way of slightly redressing the generational imbalance that we now have, which is that the parents who are able to leverage the equity in their house in order to be able to pay for deposits for younger members of their family are people who probably didn't find it as difficult as it is nowadays to buy their own house. So that's one way of kind of allowing it to cascade down the generations. But of course, the problem is if you don't have wealthy parents, or at least parents who are wealthy enough to have a decent amount of equity in their house, then you're not going to be able to do that. And even though you might be doing quite well financially, it's almost like I don't want to use too emotive language here, but a situation where people are just kind of stuck and might never be able to own their own home and might always have to rent because it's just out of reach for them, whereas some contemporaries who have parents that can give them or lend them a £100,000 deposit can get on the property ladder, and then they'll have a massive advantage in years to come, won't they?
They will, and also don't forget multiple siblings. If you're an only child, then your luck's in.
Yeah.
You've got both parents and maybe both sets of grandparents, you know, either if they give you money to get around inheritance tax rules by giving it 7 years or more before they die. Difficult one to predict, but that's a great way of passing on money and keeping it out of the Chancellor's hands. Maybe they've died already. Maybe you've inherited some money. But if there's more than one of you, you've got two brothers and three sisters, you know, that money goes for your ways. You might have an older sibling who gets there first, and the parents think, well, you know, we'll help the eldest one get onto the property ladder, and by the time the middle one and the youngest one come along, the money's run out. But certainly I can tell you about a story. I don't think I'm breaking too many confidences, but the FT is running in the newspaper tomorrow, which I wrote this afternoon, which is about some new research that the London School of Economics and Santander have had done, which basically looks 15 years into the future to the year 2030. And what they predict will happen to house prices in between now and then is some strong stuff, and, you know, big enough news to warrant a substantial story in the FT tomorrow. My conclusion, having read that report, is that inheriting a property is one of the only ways that young people today will be able to get on to the London housing ladder in future, because the rate that property prices are going up has been outstripping the rate that average earnings are going up for more than 50 years, and the gap, especially in the capital, keeps increasing. Now, that, coupled with the lack of supply, means that prices are just only ever going to go one way. And the professor, Paul Cheshire, who from the LSE, who's written this report, which will be in tomorrow's paper and on the website from midnight tonight, he goes so far to say that he doesn't think that things like population growth and lots of foreign buyers buying in London have had anywhere near the effect that the media think they have. I mean, it sounds exciting, make good headlines. He thinks the only thing that can reverse this perpetual acceleration is if supply is dramatically increased. And for that to happen, we really need radical change in the planning laws of this country, not the incentives that the current government is providing, which they welcome, and certainly nearly 90,000 people have signed up for both Help to Buy London and the government's new proposed starter homes initiative in the last 2 weeks. So that shows you that people really, really need help. But these schemes won't be able to help, you know, even a fraction of the people who've signed up for them. The only way that you can really create meaningful change in this market is to be building significantly more homes. And instead of incentivising the house builders and the market to keep the status quo going by subsidising those house prices, which keep going up and up, which is creating a false market, if you like, for house prices, to look at how you can actually provide more. And I'm sure your listeners in the southwest will know of many places that they perhaps walk past on their way to work or see at the weekend when they go out, at the sites that are either buildings that aren't used or pieces of land that have just never come into use. Many of them are owned by bits of government. There's loads in Hackney and East London where I live. There's factories all around that have been disused for years, but nobody wants to grant a planning permission creating employment land into residential because they think that they're going to lose jobs from the borough, even though these places have been empty for decades. That's starting to change now. But then you've got lots of government-owned sites by institutions like, you know, hospitals, NHS trusts, local councils. It's very, very hard for the government to know all of the land that effectively is under its control. And certainly they're trying to do an audit, and have been for the last year or so, to identify sites that could possibly be sold and turned into housing. Or better still, if the government financed a non-profit system of housing on those sites itself, you know, bring back council housing. Lots of people have argued for that, so you can have truly affordable rents in locales. Or another way would be to grant planning permission not to the house builders who are selling the homes, but to big institutions like the pension funds in Britain, who are all very interested in this American model of what the Americans call multi-family housing, which in essence means a block of flats which is owned and managed by the same company, not lots and lots of individual buy-to-let landlords who all want to make a profit, but one company that can cut the management cost because they're managing a whole block at a time. And in the UK, this is known as PRS, which I think is an unfortunate title because to me it's always sounded a bit like PMT. But PRS stands for the private rented sector. And certainly in the last budget that we had, there were some nods within policy to make it easier for those kinds of groups to get planning permission. But if they're to be able to outbid the likes of Barratt Homes, Redrow and Persimmon on site, then they'll need some kind of restrictive covenant on the land that says only that type of housing can be built. Otherwise, it will be sold to the person who can make the most profit out of it, and it's always going to be those commercial house builders who, I've argued in my column in the FT, have made more money out of this Help to Buy initiative than anyone else. Their share prices have all soared off the back of it for the last 3 years. I mean, Redrow, which is one of the biggest house builders on the London Stock Exchange, more than 40% of the homes it built in the last financial year have some form of Help to Buy used on the purchase.
If we could just focus on the politics of this for a couple of minutes, because you mentioned about, you know, how really the only solution to this is going to be to build more houses. In fact, not just build a few more houses, build a lot more houses. I know you keep hearing this figure of 250,000 just to stand still, and we're still nowhere near that and haven't been for many, many years, so it just keeps getting worse and worse. But political realities are... actually, my guest in the first half, Mark Wadsworth, mentioned about this, that there's actually a very clear link between governments being re-elected and house prices. So when house prices do drop, even just temporarily, then incumbent governments get kicked out. It's quite clear from the data. So in a way, it's kind of the British public's fault that we're in the situation that we're in, because
it makes us feel secure. Those of us who
exactly.
do own a house, you see a headline on, you know, the Daily Mail or the front of the Daily Express saying house prices have gone up £1,600 a day or a week, which is often how they report it. And it's completely wrong to say that. I mean, your house is an investment. It's a thing that you
exactly.
live in.
But I always find it really strange to say that, because I own my own house, and I sort of do slightly empathise with that, in that you see that house prices going up and you get a little warm, fuzzy feeling in your stomach. You think, oh, well, you know, that means I'm a little bit richer than I was, you know, last week or last month or last year. But actually, unless you're in the final house that you're ever going to be in, then rising house prices aren't a good thing for you, because it just means that the next house you want to move to is just that little bit further out of your grasp. So if you don't own a house, or you don't think you're in the house you're going to retire and live in for the rest of your life, then rising house prices aren't a good thing. And yet it doesn't feel like that, does it?
No, it doesn't. But people are always going to have that little prick of greediness and think, oh, you know, I'm glad that I'm on the ladder. And this is why these policies like Help to Buy, you know, feed into this mania to want to own your own home. But then can you blame young people for wanting to own their own home? I mean, since the 60s, certainly in London, property prices have doubled every 8 years.
Exactly.
And there's been some, you know, ups and downs along the way, but that's the red diagonal line going upwards. At the same time, people's pensions haven't delivered, other investments that they've made, you know, the stock market, well, you all see that on news at 10, you know, great big headlines whenever there's a big fall. We never do anything on it when it goes back up again. But there's a real lack of trust. I mean, this has been one of the big boom factors behind buy-to-let, and the fact that people have had confidence. 2 million people in Britain, we believe, own a buy-to-let property. Some of those only own one, some of them might own 50 or 100. I mean, surprisingly, normal people can have quite large buy-to-let portfolios because they've bought well early on and then they've remortgaged the pack, as it were, had a bit of a reshuffling of the debt and have used that to acquire another one. And they've gone on and on like that, maybe acquiring a new property every year or 2 years and paying a firm to manage for them. They've done fantastically well over the last 20 years. This new tax coming in on buy-to-let, which starting in April, there's going to be less tax relief on your mortgage interest, which previously you used to be able to reclaim off your earnings. You can't do that so much anymore. And if you buy a second property after the 1st of April, then you'll have an additional 3% of stamp duty to pay. So that is creating some mild optimism within the people in my office and people who I know in my personal life who are trying to buy a house, because they think, well, maybe it will take some of the heat out of the market. There'll be fewer buyers, so prices will go down. But you know what? It's just going to encourage even more first-time buyers probably to come in. So I don't think that we will see any drastic tumbles. And certainly there's no incentive for existing buy-to-let landlords to sell. The change in taxation that's coming about is not that drastic, unless you're really, really over leveraged and are not very good at managing your buy-to-let, then it will probably mean that you make less profit, but it might not mean that you make no profit, and there won't be very many people who will tip into the loss.
I mean, the political side of this, as we were just talking about, there's another important aspect, isn't there, which is, for want of a better word, NIMBYism, which is that, I mean, I've witnessed this firsthand. A good friend of mine contacted me a few years ago because he knew I did stuff in and around the media, and he said, could you help me out? I'm going on the radio, I'm talking. And I said, all right, what are you talking about? And he said, oh, well, there's there's a new housing development that's being proposed in my village, and I'm spearheading a protest group against it, and you know, I've been invited onto the radio, and I talked him through, you know, the kind of questions he might get asked and what he might need to do, and I was sort of coaching him. And at one point I threw in the question, I said, this is just NIMBYism, isn't it? And he had a really good answer. It was like, you know, it's not about NIMBYism, it's about, you know, this is the wrong site, you know, there's not enough of this, blah blah blah. And there were various reasons he gave, and then when I kind of spoke to him after we'd done the little rehearsal, and I said, it is NIMBYism though, isn't it? And he said, yeah, it is. He admitted it. And that's the problem, isn't it? Wherever, you know, new housing developments are proposed, there are always protest groups that spring up and say, we just don't want them here. We're not opposed to house building in general, just not here. There's always a just not here.
But then what are those people going to say when their children or their grandchildren can't get on the housing ladder, when people can't afford to live in the same town or city as their relatives, when employers can't afford to employ staff in certain locations because the housing costs are so high? I mean, even Deloitte, who are one of the big four firms of accountants, they've permanently taken over part of the Olympic Village residential development and are using that for their graduate trainees, so that they can say to their graduate trainees, you know, if you join us, we've got a flat that you can move into. Now, they still have to pay rent on it, but I would wager that it's probably quite a good rent by market standards, and it's easy for them to find a good place to live. They don't have to spend 3 months running around to find out that this flat is gone, or deal with a landlord who hasn't put in proper furniture or done a gas check, or you know, is renting out a substandard or even dangerous property. I mean, these things, sadly, are a fact of the market when demand outstrips supply, that dodgy practices will go on. It's very, very hard to regulate against them. So in response to your question about what the politicians are doing or what they should do, the only real solution to get rid of NIMBYism is to centralise government planning decisions. No one in a council has got any incentive at all to vote through a new housing development, because as you say, even if people think generously that their children and their grandchildren will benefit from having a house that they can potentially buy or rent, and that it will tip the supply balance in young people's favour, they're still never going to want it. People's personal considerations will always come to the fore. So the council won't approve it because the councillors themselves are worried about being re-elected. Nobody wants to be the person who delivers bad news to the local electorate. So simply take it out of their hands. Centralise these planning decisions and say that they have to go through, because we're getting to a stage now in the housing market. If something radical isn't done, then the consequences for young people, they may take a decade or more to really be visibly seen in social research, but they're not able to save for a pension, they're not able to save for a deposit, they're not having an asset that those who have gone before them have had, and that's the expectation that they really want, knowing that the pension isn't going to provide for them. So, you know, people of my generation, we might have a rubbish pension, but we know that we've got a property and we feel a bit more comforted by that. But the generation below me haven't got either.
So there's a demographic time bomb coming.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we run a piece this week, on last Friday, actually, about millennials, those in their 20s, and how they would rather go on holiday than pay into a pension, or indeed save up for a housing deposit, because they can see that it's just futile. They need to save up so much money to either buy a house or provide for themselves in the future. We had a very respected financial planner saying, you know, from the age of 25, if you want to retire on an income of £30,000 a year or equivalent, from the age of 25, you'll need to be putting £800 a month into your pension. And if you're not putting £800 in when you're 25, if you're only putting in £400, say, then you need to make up those payments in later life. And young people have been absolutely horrified. It's caused this huge Twitter storm. We've had BuzzFeed, Reddit, all of these things writing articles about us saying, you know, the FT cannot be serious, £800 a month into a pension. But that is the reality, because you don't have these generous gold-plated final salary pensions anymore. You have company-run schemes which are invested in the stock market and over time produce much poorer returns. And how well they might do isn't guaranteed. It's dependent on the whim of the market. So even that projection of somebody saying that they think that you'll have £30,000income per year when you retire age 65, that's just a projection. There's no certainty to pensions anymore, even less certainty with the budget coming up. We don't know what changes are going to lie ahead. Pensions have been repetitively stripped of their relevance by successive governments, both Labour and Conservative, over the past 20 years, and they're not the blanket that they once were. And it will take another generation of people retiring for the generation below to fully realise this. Now, at the moment, people are thinking, great, it's all right, my pension hasn't provided for me, but my property's gone up in value 300%, so I can either remortgage or I can do equity release, which is something that's never been more popular, where you borrow against the value of your house while you're still alive, and the interest all rolls up, and then your children think, oh, goody gumdrops, I'm going to inherit mum and dad's property because they've just popped their clogs. And then they find out that there's this horrific loan tied up on the property that they knew nothing about, and the actual equity left has been whittled down to next to nothing.
I'm not sure there's much to be optimistic about in this conversation.
I know, really. I'm depressing all of your all of your listeners. I'm sure you've got some great music that you can that you can play. We can all pour ourselves a glass of wine.
I better hope the next track's very, very good, actually, to counterbalance this conversation. Thanks very much for your time tonight, Claire. It's been great speaking to you. How can people follow you on social media and also read your stuff in the FT?
You've very kindly tweeted my account. I'm at Claire B. My name is spelled C-L-A-E-R, like aeroplane.
Yeah,
so remember it.
When I tried to put that into my word processor, without even asking me, just spell checked it back to Clear. Actually, in my notes in front of me.
How transparent I am as a journalist.
and you write in the FT regularly.
I write in the FT. I edit the personal finance section, which is called FT Money. It comes out every Saturday and Sunday in the weekend FT. You can buy it on either day. It's on sale across the weekend. We'll have lots about property in this week's issue. We'll also have quite a lot about tax, and we'll have a full report on the Twitter storm that our millennials and pensions article caused, with some hilarious cat pictures. The young responded to pensions horror by posting pictures of cats.
You've always got to have pictures of cats. They've always got to be somewhere in this, I find.
Yeah.
All right, good stuff. Thanks very much for your time this evening, Claire. That's Claire Barrett, who is the personal finance editor of the Financial Times, talking about house prices for young people and also pensions that probably aren't going to do what we hope they're going to do. It's not fair. You've been listening to Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill. We've been talking about land value tax with Mark Wadsworth of the Young People's Party, and also about house prices and how that affects young people and pensions and various other things with Claire Barrett, who's the personal finance editor of the Financial Times. Hope you've enjoyed tonight. Thanks for listening. I'm not going to be here for the next couple of weeks, so I'll be back in 3 weeks' time with more guests and more discussion about topical and not so topical. See you then.